This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Catherine Hammond, Family Transition Coordinator for the Arc of Illinois, who is a tireless advocate for closure of state institutions and has an amazing personal story as well. So stay tuned for that. But first, disability news for the week of September 2nd, 2019. New research suggests that the prevalence of autism is on the rise, and it's growing at a significantly faster clip among certain groups of kids. Between 2007 and 2013, autism rates increased 73% among Hispanics and 44% among Black children ages 3 to 5. At the same time, prevalence rose only 25% for white children in that age bracket. The findings come from a study published this month in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders. Researchers looked at data collected nationwide under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and information available from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, which regularly tracks prevalence in 8-year-olds in 11 communities. Said Cynthia Nevison of the University of Colorado Boulder, who led the study, quote, "We found that rates among Blacks and Hispanics are not only catching up to those of whites, which have historically been higher, but surpassing them," end quote. Traditionally, autism rates among minority groups have lagged, a factor often attributed to lack of awareness and resources in such communities. However, the new study found that prevalence among Black children surpassed whites in 30 states by 2012. The most recent figures from the CDC, which were released last year, indicate that 1 in 59 children have autism. The estimate is based on data collected on 8-year-olds in 2014 through the Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network. Since the start of the century, the government's official estimate of autism prevalence has increased 150%. The Massachusetts town of Danvers has 5 small elementary schools. The switch to the town's biggest middle school, which for the first time students walk the halls on their own between classes, can be a little scary. It's even more daunting for students with disabilities. That's one reason the district's technology director, Jeff Lieberman, purchased a 360-degree camera and recruited student videographers to help with a project. This year, students taking a video production class will create a virtual tour of the middle school. The goal is to give new students a chance to explore their future school in advance in a low-stress environment. Last year, a student intern created a similar tour of the town's high school, and it was so popular that Lieberman wants one for every school. About 16% of the 3,800 students in Danvers public schools get services because they have disabilities. Virtual reality is becoming an increasingly important tool for serving them. While the use of VR in schools has been growing in recent years, thanks in part to more affordable resources, Danvers is becoming a leader in finding applications of VR that help students with disabilities. The school tour isn't the district's first foray into creating its own virtual reality. Its first tour was of downtown Danvers. Some students who receive special education services take a life skills class to prepare for living as independently as possible after high school, and one of the class activities is a real-life walk around downtown. Teachers told Lieberman it would be helpful if students could take the trip virtually as a practice round before the class outing, and using Google's virtual reality tour creator and Google Maps Street View, the technology department made it possible to take a 15-minute walk virtually from the high school to downtown, turning from one street to another and stopping at each stoplight. Lieberman said it can be particularly helpful for students to have a chance to walk at their own pace, using as much time as they want to take everything in. That's not the case in a real-life field trip. They also help students learn calming techniques through mindfulness instruction and let them practice those techniques in otherwise trying locations like busy train stations. Danvers Public Schools, along with Google, will host a conference in November to share strategies for using virtual reality to better serve students with special needs. Across the district, students experience virtual and augmented reality in social studies, science, and language arts classes, and Lieberman expects foreign language teachers to bring it to their classrooms this year as well. But it's the special focus on virtual reality for kids in special education that sets Danvers apart, and Lieberman is excited to share what Danvers has learned with other districts. And finally, special education paraeducators, or aides, recently completed a 3-day session focused on how each paraeducator can better support English learners. It's a necessary skill in Washington, where a full third of students come from linguistically diverse homes, compared to just 12% across the state. By the start of this school year, all 295 school districts in Washington must provide similar training for their instructional paraeducators. The pending deadline is challenging many districts, and they may be harried as most will need to bargain the extra training time with their local unions. An added wrinkle, in 2017, state lawmakers pledged to fully fund a mandatory 4-day training course for all paraeducators, but budget negotiations during this year's legislative session provided only enough money to pay for half. There's also growing recognition that it's not just paraeducators who need better training, and that the teachers that paraeducators are supposed to support could benefit from learning exactly how to work with the extra adult in their classrooms, said Deb Eldridge, dean and academic vice president for the Teachers College at Western Governors University in Washington. Quote, "This isn't an aspect of teacher prep that's done particularly well," end quote. Eldridge previously worked with a national accreditor to vet teacher preparation programs, and many, she said, spent little time helping teachers to understand how to work with paraeducators. As for its work to support paraeducators, she said, quote, "Washington is ahead of the curve," end quote. As for a separate challenge, Washington officials see a solution: turning paraeducators into teachers to bridge a vexing cultural divide between the state's largely white teachers and their increasingly diverse students. It makes sense, they say, because paraeducators often grow up in the same neighborhoods as their students. Quote, "Paraeducators are more diverse than teachers. They speak different languages and their community connections are stronger," said Alexandra Manuel, executive director of the Professional Educator Standards Board. To recruit more diverse candidates into teacher roles, the state has approved nearly 24 Grow Your Own programs in which school districts and colleges help working paraeducators get their teaching licenses. As of last year, paraeducators can apply for up to $4,000 in conditional loans to cover tuition and other college costs if they agree to teach for at least 2 years in Washington. There's also hope that drawing paraeducators from special education, high poverty, and English learner programs will close the teacher shortages in those subject areas. And that's the news for this week.
Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by my good friend Catherine Hammond, who is a staff person with the Arc of Illinois. She is the Family Transition Coordinator. Is that still your correct title, Catherine?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
We call it the Family Transition Project. I always wanted it to be a project rather than a program.
Yes.
Because a program sounds so stuffy and formal, and it's, we kind of are always trying new things to make this work.
Yeah, and you have been an advocate for a really long time, not as long as some of us, because you have a very interesting personal story. I want to cover both your personal story and your work with the ARC. Which do you want to do first?
Let's start with the personal story, because that actually explains why I do what I do and how I got involved with the ARC.
Okay, I say go ahead.
Well, I am the sister of Margaret Castle Doring, and I love giving my sister her full name, because I think people with disabilities are often robbed of their identity, along with so many other things. And she is 76 now. She was born 10 years before I was. I did not know her until I was an adult. I didn't, in fact, even know that my sister existed. I had an older and younger brother, and they also didn't know about her. My older brother was kind of nosy, and he saw a lot of letters from Dixon, Illinois, from Dixon State School, which is where she was sent at the age of 2. And he figured out, you know, he wanted to know who this person was. And he asked my mom, and she was very distressed and said, "Don't tell your younger siblings." Anyway, to make a long story short, eventually the three of us did find out about it, but not till we were preteens, I would say. And I was completely shocked. I'd always wanted a sister. And my mom described her as feeble-minded and said that she had been in an institution since she was 2 because she really couldn't live in the outside world, and that they had not expected her to live past puberty. Well, I wasn't particularly encouraged to go meet her. They never went there, and I found out when I became her guardian much later, that there was a period of time of 17 years when no one even visited where she was
living. Oh, my gosh.
Really distressing to me. But I don't have to go through the whole history of how things change around the country, especially with the Kennedys and Special Olympics and a lot of things that happened, the Willowbrook story and everything. There started to be a push for things like human rights committees and for people actually doing something in the state.
Didn't you volunteer at the institution where she was housed at one point?
I did. And I started, I went and visited her at Dixon, and I found out they were looking for a guardian for her. And I was 26 or 7, I think, and she, of course, was 36 or 7 when we first met. And I became her guardian. Dixon closed. I helped her move to Howe Center in Tinley Park because that was the closest to where I lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a volunteer there, and I eventually I started working in volunteer services, and I got transferred around. But I was a state employee at Howe Center, where she was living for 11 years. I helped her move to Ascilla, and she's been living there now since she was 65.
And for those who are listening who don't know what Ascilla stands for, can you just briefly describe that?
Oh, sure. Community Integrated Living Arrangement. I tend to say group home, even though I really don't like that.
That's the term that people know, I think,
right,
is group
people
home.
People understand that when you say mm-hmm. that. So so she's lived there for about 11 years now and has done very well. When Howe Center closed, and boy, once I started working there, I realized a lot of things that I realized as a family member, and I was glad to see it close. But I was
for what can you just kind of summarize some of the reasons why you felt that way?
Absolutely, and this goes to my passion for closing state-operated developmental centers. There is a culture that is very negative in the state-operated developmental centers. And it's a culture of lack of respect for the people who are supported. And in fact, it goes from just day-to-day. Don't get me wrong, there are very nice people to this day who work in state-operated developmental centers. And there are some people who really try to help people have more independence and a less institutional life. But basically, it's built on dependence, the thought that your caregivers and the schedule of the day, everything is built around the convenience of staff and everything being in a certain order, and it's not built on freedom of choice. It's a major deal to start working on things like someone doesn't have to take a shower at shower time, or someone can actually eat at a different time of day. But and I know some of the centers have made some progress in these areas, but basically it ranges from just being very inconvenient for people and people not having much choice and independence to actual abuse, which I observed and reported as a state employee. And I talked to people who lived there, and of course, a lot. And some of the people that I knew there reported things, which was very brave of them, because it's very hard to be living somewhere and report someone who's working with it. Even if that person goes on suspension or whatever, all the other people who are working with me also work with that person. And it can be a very hostile atmosphere.
Yeah. So your sister moved from Howe Developmental Center into a group home, and what changed for her in that move?
What changed for her right away is that she had her own room, which she had never had. And that's a perfect example I can give of something that may not seem horrible, you know, like terrible kinds of abuse, but when she lived in the state center, she shared with two other women. And so she had no privacy. And it wasn't until I saw her living in the group home that I realized how much she valued that. My sister, I should say, doesn't speak. And she doesn't communicate with sign or in any of the more conventional ways that people might communicate. So you have to get to know her quite well to understand how she might feel about things. And even then, it's something that, you know, is always troubling. I'm always trying to figure out what's going on and how she's feeling. I do know when she's feeling happy, that's great, because that's very obvious. And when she's feeling very angry, that's very obvious. She has a very angry hum. But all those other feelings in between, or why she's feeling those things, are not always clear. So one thing that was incredibly obvious right away in the group home is that she loves having her own room. When she wants to be on her own, she hangs out in her room. When she wants to be with other people, she goes into the common area and will hang out with people. And she actually, unfortunately, this woman passed away, but she developed a friendship, the first that I've ever observed, with another woman who lived in her group home. And they had a little sort of game they would play. My sister would go by and she'd take something from the other lady, and then she would bring it back, and then they would both laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And staff who lived there said that they would sometimes just sit next to each other and hold hands. So
that's
sweet. That's just nothing like anything that I had observed with my sister in the past.
So you obviously have had a lot of personal growth through this whole experience of being a guardian for your sister and getting her moved into a group home. How did that lead to your work with the Arc of Illinois?
Well, for that very reason, when Howe was closing and I was wondering what I was going to do for a job, one of the people who worked there knew Tony Pulowski and the Arc. And he said, they're looking for someone to talk to families someone who has actually been through the experience of helping move their loved one from a state-operated developmental center to a home in the community. And that just seemed like it was... I'm a very lucky person because I'm incredibly lazy about all the, the formal job applying stuff. And I went to an interview with Tony. We liked each other right away. And I started working part-time for the ARC and then full-time for them.
And your job has been what?
My job has changed. It changes all the time. But basically, I'm the director of the Family Transition Program, which is something we developed. And the concept of it is for families to talk to families. And for people who are living in state-operated centers and their families to talk to someone who's been through a transition. And so I help give support and advocacy to families. I help connect them with people who might be able to actually help them. In the past, a lot of families didn't know about the individual service coordination agencies. They're starting to know much more now, but they didn't even realize that they could start working with them and looking at things outside of the state-operated developmental center.
So you're working with families to help them figure out that it's possible for their family member maybe to live outside of the institutional setting and maybe how that could happen for them?
Exactly. And the other thing that we've done from the beginning, and I say we because in the beginning I was working with Shirley Perez, who's now the director of the Family Support Network and the Ligas Family Advocate Program for the ARC. But from the very beginning, we knew that families needed to understand that there might be options and it would be helpful to them to see what other families had done. So we also interviewed people and their people who had moved out and their families and talked about, you know, why was the transition hard? What were things that you wish you'd known that would be helpful? And we could share that with other families. And some families would even allow us to share pictures and their personal stories because they were so pleased with how things went for them.
So what are some of the things that families identified as being hard?
That has changed at various times. I think it's still the same, that lack of information, lack of support from people who... people that they work with in the state-operated center, and lack of support from other families there who are often desperately afraid that the place is going to close. And that was something I experienced myself. My sister actually moved before HAL closed, about a year before, I think. But families then said to me, people I'd worked with for years, I mean, because I, as a volunteer, I knew lots of families. Even before I actually worked for the state, people I'd known for years said to me, how can you do this? Do you know something we don't know? You know, if people keep moving their loved ones, the place is going to close. I mean, it wasn't even lack of support. It was actual hostility. And I think that those are things people experience still now. But one of the biggest problems probably is what's affecting everyone in the disability world, and that is the providers are the two things they're very concerned about: getting the correct rate that they need to support people who have a lot of challenges, and they're concerned about staff shortage.
Yeah, so which are very, very much connected. You can't hire good people for $10 an hour anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so there's
a shortage. The amazing thing to me, though, is that I'm not saying this to be mean to anyone who's listening who works for a state-operated center, and boy, I know what it's like going in there and trying to do your best for people every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I have found people who are working for a lot less money and working with my sister to be very passionate and dedicated about what they do, often in a way that you don't see with people who are working for the state for more money. So, boy, I would like to see them be rewarded.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. And I agree with you. There are people who do the work because they just want to do the right thing for people with disabilities, and that's commendable. But they ought to be able to live without having to borrow money or, you know, go on food stamps or any of those things that happen so frequently either. So,
exactly.
Yeah. So what's coming? Any big activities coming up, or things that are regular features of your program?
Well, thank you for asking. You are such a great interviewer. this is my one other point that I especially wanted to make, and that is for the last year, I'm starting in the second year now of a new part of my program. I got tired of being the only person, so I have four people who have lived in state-operated centers who are working with me. And
awesome.
We call it the ARC Mentor Program. And it's, a lot of people say, even my own family have asked me, so are you mentoring four people? And I say, no, they're mentoring me.
Mm-hmm.
Because these four people have lived in state-operated developmental centers. And I can talk and tell my sister's story, you know, what I know of it from my point of view, but they can actually speak on their actual, real, firsthand experience of living in state-operated centers.
Right.
And that has been so, to me, it's strengthened what I'm trying to do so much, but it's very, very effective. Talking to different people. Eventually, we still haven't done a lot of work talking one-to-one with families. We have done some, and to me, that would be the biggest thrill.
Mm-hmm.
But we have actually gone inside of some state-operated centers, and some of the mentors have spoken to people. And there, like formally, the Alliance worked with us. They have an initiative.
The Alliance is the state self-advocates network, right?
Right, the Self-Advocacy Alliance. And they have worked with, they actually are working in some of the state-operated developmental centers, I guess all of them, and trying to help create self-advocacy groups there. So we've gone with them to a couple of different places. And I have just seen the kind of response that people have when they see someone that they know used to live where they're living and is living in the community now.
Yeah.
It's very moving. And I think it's very hopeful and encouraging for people.
So if people want more information about the program, about the Family Transition Program, how do they get that?
People can email me at Catherine@thearcaville.org, or they can call me at 708-465-2827.
And the website is thearcaville.org.
www.thearcaville.org.
Exactly. Okay, I will
have
try.
It right in front of me, but of course I don't.
Of course not. Thank you so much for joining me today, Catherine Hammond of the Family Transition Program of the ARC of Illinois.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/publicaffairs/disabilitybeat. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email me at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week. And you are listening to...
No, I stand my ground. Be turned around, and I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey.
and you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Before we go on to